Church. Today is Monday, March 29th, 1999. I am in Severna Park, Maryland, at the home of Ted Sapowski.
At 75. No, 76.
Okay. Yeah. And where were you born?
I was born in Wagner's Court.
Is that in Maryland?
Yeah.
Okay. And were you brought up there also?
Well, was I brought up there? Yeah. I'm the baby of 14 in the family. My mother died when my mother was 50 years old when I was born. And my dad died when I was 6 months old. So I really don't know if I just had a father. We had it tough. And I used to shine cars, clean gutters or whatever to get a few pennies to buy my first baseball club. So I just loved baseball and I was hoping that I could get to the big leagues.
When did you get interested in baseball?
I got interested in baseball when I was about 5 or 6 years old.
Did you have any special heroes or idols or teams that you followed?
Well, my idol was Babe Ruth, and I didn't know too much about following idols because I got it without a newspaper. And the only time I was see a ball game would be on the radio, but television wasn't out there. But I used to practice 5, 6 hours a day. That's how I loved the game.
And what position did you play?
Second base.
And how did you get involved with organized baseball?
I went to Mount St. Joe. I think the tuition there was $200. And I tried out for the baseball team, which was, I think, junior varsity or whatever. But the coach of the varsity team seen me play, and he said he wants me on their team, the varsity. So I skipped JV and went right to the varsity. I made the All-Maryland as a second baseman. And the following year, the brother, a principal of Mount St. Joe told my brother that he didn't have to pay the tuition anymore because I got a scholarship there. In fact, after my 3rd year, I got a scholarship to Florida University. But my brothers were in $2 book, and they told me no, sign with the Orioles. So when I signed with the Orioles...
Were the Orioles affiliated with any major league team?
Yes. When I signed with the Orioles, they had a working agreement with Cleveland. Tommy Thomas was the manager, and he was kind of like a father to me.
This was in 1942?
42, yeah. And at the end of the year, the international league season ended before the major league season. And Cleveland had a pick of 2 ball players from the Orioles. And in the meantime, Ty Cobb scouted me for the Cubs. He was a scout for the Scott Cubs. And he told the club to go as high as $50,000 for me because I was the fastest infielder he'd seen for a long time. But the Cubs couldn't touch me because Cleveland had the first option. Cleveland picked me and Eddie Robinson for $10,000 apiece. So Tommy Thomas had in my contract that if I was sold to a bigger club, I would get 10%. So I got $1,000. I thought I was making that.
What were you making prior to that with the Orioles?
I still got my cancer stuck in my scrapbook. I got a check for $99.50 for 2 weeks. It was $50 a week, and it was $200 a month. That was big money for me.
Now, you mentioned Ty Cobb. Did you actually get to meet Ty Cobb?
Yeah, I met Ty Cobb. Yeah.
What was your impression?
Well,
I mean, he was a controversial player.
Yeah, but I looked at him as a ball player, not as whatever. In fact, I had Ty autographed a baseball for him. And I made lamps for Ty Cobb. The baseball lamp I'm going to show you when we finish this one. And I had a bar hard grip, a fist speaker, Jimmy Foster up the road. So things were kind of slow as far as finances. So I put an ad in Sporting News. And a professor from the University of Michigan wrote me and said, Ted, he said, I saw your ad in Sporting News. I'll give you $250 for that Ty Cobb ball. So that was a lot of money for us. We were poor. So I sold it to him. And the ball now is worth $10,000. But who knows?
Okay, so you came up with Cleveland towards the end of 1942.
Yes.
And you were in five games. What was your impression of being in the big leagues?
Oh, I was so nervous. Yeah.
Were you at Cleveland or on the road?
I was at Cleveland. I was on the road with the two afterwards, you know. But the way they lived in the big leagues, the way I was used to living, I just couldn't believe the first class attention we got now. As I recall, my first game was against the Yankees. And sleep that night. And the Yankees are in town. Well, we dressed, took them to a practice, and I looked at the stands, they're almost packed. 76,000 people. I've never seen that many people in my life. I was so nervous that after the first ground ball was hit to me, I got the man out. I felt so good. If I'm not mistaken, I got one or two hits that day. But that was a big thrill for me to be in the big leagues.
Now, who were some of the players other than Goodrow on the team? Was Bob Feller still there?
Bob Feller was a nice guy. Kenny Cutler, Joe Gordon, Eddie Robinson, he came up with me, and Steve Gromick, and I kind of forget.
Mel Harder, was he still with you?
He was pitcher, yeah, Mel Harder, yeah. And Don Black, I think. And I got to know all the boys, they were teammates. So,
how did Cleveland finish that year?
I think we finished fourth or fifth.
Then next year, in 43, you were back with Baltimore?
And then I went to the Coast Guard. We had a major league club in the Coast Guard. We had Sid Gordon, Del Savio, Hank Schauer, and we played major league clubs, plus service teams. We had a powerhouse. I remember we had the Cleveland Indians play us, because I belonged to them. And I think we beat them 8-2 or whatever. And the big part I remember is I hit 2 home runs at them. So we go really impressive.
Do you remember where that was played at?
It was a Curtis Bay yard, Coast Guard yard, yeah. I think the right field fence then was about 363 feet. I mean, 2 over.
And you're still playing second base?
Yeah.
Yeah, you batted left, correct?
Yeah.
And you threw right.
Right.
So you were in the Coast Guard for 2 years?
Yeah.
44 and 45?
Yeah.
Then in 46, you were with started with Oklahoma City?
Yeah, I played an option at Oklahoma City.
That was double A?
Yeah, it was double A, triple A. But I had a pretty good year. I hit 300, so.
Yeah, 300, right on the button.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you came up to Cleveland towards the end of the year?
Yeah. And I think that Ray Matthews was the ball club, yeah. Then I kind of was a substitute infielder. I remember one game that we're playing Philadelphia. And playing third base, Bob Feller was pitching, and he picked Barney McCoskey off third base, and he put a spike wound in my knee. It took 15 stitches, and I was finished for the year.
You had pretty good. You batted 500, 4-for-8 that year. Mm-hmm. All right. Then 1947, you started with Cleveland.
Yeah.
How did you get to the Yankees?
Cleveland sold me to the Yankees. Yeah. And I was a substitute infielder. I was a pinch runner and whatever. And I remember playing the Mets at the Polo Grounds, and I played, Casey Stengel was the manager, and I played left field. And I took that ball game, we got two or three hits. But we had the whole Yankee squad there. And
could that have been the Giants?
Yeah. And when I was with the Yankees, it seemed to me that you were one step harder than the other major league guys because of the tradition the Yankees had. And I would notice that going to the hotels, we'd have a band of Yankees out of town. And inside of 50 people downstairs, looking or waiting for the ball players to come in, when the Yankees came to town, you'd have 250 people going to the autograph or whatever. There was something prestige about the Yankees. And I roomed with Yogi Berra. And I roomed with Dr. Brown. Bobby Brown, third base. I remember a game in Chicago. He had infield practice, and the ball was hit to Bobby, hit a stone or something, and it broke his little finger. And of course, he was out of the ball game. But it was infield practice, came out of surgery. So, living with Bobby, we would get up about 10, 11, and we would have breakfast, and we had some time to kill. So we'd go to the malls and look at different things. And we stopped at one mall, and some elderly gentleman said, "Are you Bobby Brown?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "What happened to your finger?" And Bobby said, "I broke it into your practice." And he says, "I got a cure for it. My grandmother told me that if I broke a finger, to take a lemon, put a hole in it, and massage it, and your bone will heal faster than nature would take, you know." And Bobby and I went to an A&P store and got six lemons. And we put a hole in it and started massaging it at home, you know, because he couldn't play. He could rest for the ball game, but he couldn't play. And by golly, I think about 2 weeks or something like that, he was ready to go. And he couldn't breathe it. Well, anyway, after he retired, was out of baseball, he's president of America today. So I wrote Bobby a letter. And I said, "Bobby, I don't know if you remember it or not. My number is 14, yours is 6. Do you remember the incident in Chicago where you broke your finger and we had a bar of lemons?" And he wrote me from the president's office in New York, whatever. He said, "Ted, I remember like it happened yesterday." He says, "I called the Yankees. They're going to send you a cap, a Yankee cap." And he said, "When I get to Baltimore, I stay at the Cross Keys, I'll give you a call, and we'll go out together." Now, that was a space of about 40-some years. And he reminded me of that.
And did he call you when you got...
No, he retired or something before he came with the team. I don't know just what happened to him.
Now, back in when you were playing together, was he studying for medicine at that time?
Yeah.
We'd heard stories that
yes,
he was studying.
Yes, he was, because he would have all kinds of medical books in the hotel room. Came recorded.
And what's your favorite Yogi Berra story?
My favorite story of Yogi Berra was we were in Chicago or Detroit, and he was singing, and he had a date that night, and he said, "Kid, do you have any kind of ties I can wear?" He had a dark blue suit. I said, "Yogi," I said, "the only one I have is a green tie." He says, "That's okay." And I said, "Yogi, a green tie and a blue suit doesn't go." He says, "A girl I'm going out with is colorblind." There are times to answer sometimes you didn't. And the big thing I remember is normally people ask me my highlights of my baseball career or something that happened that we thought he was kind of funny. We were playing Boston, and my father was catching. And I was playing second base. And Ted Williams was the hitter. And the fellow had him 2-2. And the umpire was Eddie Rommel, who comes from Melbourne. And in fact, I remember Eddie umpired a game when he played the Yankees when I was a Cleveland. And Yogi Berra was catching and he said, Yogi, this ball better be right over the middle of the plate before I call it a strike on this boy. He comes from Maryland. He called Yogi that. But now going to Ted Williams' story, we're playing the Red Sox and Ted's batting. Talking about Ted Williams. He is the only ball player that I know that when the home team takes back practice and infield practice, they go in and change shirts from the shirts soaking wet from the spine or whatever. But we didn't go in to change shirts when Boston was hitting, when Ted Williams was hitting. We would watch him hit. If you finish hitting, then we go in and change our shirt. Anyway, coming to the story again. I thought I was pitching, Williams hitting, and Jim Hegan was a catcher, Eddie Rummel was a umpire. And Fellow had him 2-2. Tight score, 1-0, whatever. But, and Fellow not only had a fastball, he clocked down about 105, 10 miles an hour. And he had a wicked curveball that would drop off the table. In fact, I remember him striking Ken Greenberg about 4 straight times when he threw. So Fellow's got him 2-2. And he throws him a wicked curveball and it nipped the inside corner. And Eddie Rummel says, ball three. And he can turn around and he says, damn, Rummel, that pitch hit the inside corner. So he took his mask, Rummel took his face mask off and tapped Hegan on the shoulder. He says, Jim, listen, if this guy can hit 406, he's got better eyes than I got. Williams let it go for a ball. Yeah. Anyway, I tell that story to a lot of people.
DiMaggio's with the Yankees, right?
Yeah.
Any impressions?
He was a kind of individualist, but a good teammate. And in fact, when we went out on the road, he had a private room in a hotel. And everything was good perfection. I remember, they don't do it now, playing Pepper. You know what Pepper used to be?
Yeah, sort of.
Well, five or six guys get on the side, and they throw the ball to the hitter. And if you drop one, you owe the guys a coke or something. But every time we would hit at DiMaggio, he would always throw you a ball in the strike zone, even though you're throwing Pepper. And he was such a perfectionist. When you warmed up with Joe, he would always throw you the ball right here. And of course, he just dressed neat and shirt and tie. And whenever we went on the road to the Yankees and we would go into the dining room to get our dinner, everybody would say, here's DiMaggio, here's DiMaggio. And another story about Joe was when he was operating on his heel in 1947 at Hopkins, a fight promoter named Benny Trotter. Benny asked Joe if he could go to the racetrack. And Joe said, this is Tuesday, I'm going to be out there on Thursday. And he got the permission from the doctor. So when we got out of Hopkins, Joe asked me to go too. Big limousine pulled up. And Benny Trotter said, that's my chauffeur. And he took us to Pimlico Racetrack. And we sat in Alfred Green Vanderbilt seats, cushion type seats. And when the race, Joe would always play number five, he put $20 to win on. So it was his number. And after the race, you kind of get up to go and get your soft drink or whatever, Sam. But it wasn't there in Vanderbilt boxes. You'd have a colored waiter bringing your dinner, your sandwich or whatever. It was first class. From there, we went to Maria's restaurant. The waitress, they had a violin band playing for us and everything. And the waitress said that, Mr. DiMaggio, there's a barber down the street. Would you mind if I ask you if I could tell him that you're here? And the barber came, stood in his barbershop garb, like, and the comb and the scissors, and he had a ball. He said, Mr. DiMaggio, you are my idol for years and years. Would you mind autographing this ball? and his hands were kind of shaking. And the manager looked at him, and he said, this boy right here comes from Maryland, and he's my teammate this year. Let him sign the first, and I'll sign it afterwards. And he didn't back the ball.
That was a nice gesture.
Wasn't that nice? Yeah. I always remember him by that. So, in 48, I was optioned to Newark. And I think Stoneweiss or somebody broke his hand or something. And I think I only lasted 2 weeks or so as a utility infielder. But I never did get many games. I was a pinch runner or whatever. And then they sent me back. And in 48 with Newark, I think I hit 23 home runs.
24.
24. And who was my teammate was Joe Collins and Gene Woodling and Heslett. We finished second, I think. Syracuse beat us in the playoffs. Bill Skip was our manager. We had a terrific team.
When you were with the Yankees in 47, they won the pennant. Were you still with them at the
time? No.
Okay, so you had a good year. And then in 49, you were with Newark also, in Kansas City.
Yeah, Kansas City. They wanted a winning club, Kansas City. And 3/4 of the team from Newark were out from Kansas City to help out. You know, Joe Collins and me and Bob Coleman and whatever.
What were you making about that, salary-wise? I should say, when you went to the Yankees in Cleveland.
I don't know if the minimum was $7,000. It was so long ago.
It was the minimum.
Yeah, it was the
now, I guess even if you got that and you switched into the minors, you still would keep that.
Oh, yeah. Do you know what the salary is in the big league now?
Yes.
$200,000.
Well, it's more than that.
No, it's not
the average. The minimum.
Yeah. Can you picture a guy playing with Bowie and getting recalled by the Orioles? He's making about $10,000 or so with Bowie, unless the Orioles opting him there and taking half of his, signed contract. But a regular guy making $10,000-$15,000 with Bowie, that's big money here in AA. And he goes to the Yankees, and he puts that uniform on, and he makes $200,000. Anyway, this is 1999.
Did Kansas City win that year, by the way?
I don't know. No, we didn't win the pennant.
In 1950, you went to Springfield.
Yeah, Springfield Cubs. Well, evidently, maybe I was chosen to Chicago Cubs, because Springfield was front of the Cubs. And I hit the first home run in the park. It was on a Sunday, and I think they presented me with $100 or $500 bond.
It was a brand new park?
Brand new park, yeah.
And then 51, you were at Springfield, and then you went to Milwaukee.
Yeah.
Is that still a Cub?
No, Milwaukee's Braves.
Right.
And
the American Association.
Yeah. Here's a big story about the Braves. I did you say why I went to Hartford?
That's next year. Okay. 52.
I went to Hartford. They were eyeing me as a future manager. So in Hartford, I played under Del Bissonnette. And whenever he'd be ejected from a ball game or something, I would take over as manager. So the Milwaukee Braves, the following year, I think it's 53, they made me manager of Roseville, New York.
Right. Tony was
now. And he trained at Wake Forest, Georgia. And we had 5 diamonds. And the managers were set kind of like a rotunda. They were set on top and supervised different diamonds or whatever. And I had it tough because I was a player manager. I had to watch my ball players because I was class D and get myself in shape. And the next team from club, I think, was Jacksonville. Ben Garrity was the manager of Jacksonville. He was the... Now, after workouts, the managers would have conferences. And Ben Garrity would take off those for matching, last week, because he see that they're pretty good. And the two ball players I had on my team, I was so tickled to have them, and I had them for one day. And at the meeting, Ben Garrity said, "Ted, I'm going to take two ball players from the infield. I think they're going to be future major leaguers." And the two ball players that he took from my Roswell team was Hank Aaron and Felix Ventura. I managed Hank Aaron for one day. Of course, then he came.
What were your impressions of Aaron at the time?
Oh, skinny, hit driver ball 400 feet. Just beautiful, yeah. He's a shortstop. Ventura was something else. And the following year, I don't know what we finished, but then 54, and you see that in 53, I hit 38 home runs.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. By the way, Wellsville, where is that? Where was that located?
Around Olean.
In New York?
And Corning. Oh, and Cornell.
Okay. Upstate New York. Okay. Now, in 53 and 54, you were the manager. In 53, you hit 339. In 54, you hit 377. Both years, you led the league in total bases, home runs, and RBIs.
Yes.
Now, compared to your previous record, this was a tremendous, jump.
Well, you get to know a little more, whatever. And the record was only at the 30. And I broke the record. In fact, they had a date for me, and they were going to get me a car. But something happened that the deal with the car dealership fell through. So I got cash and gifts at home plate. Mike was there, my two daughters were there. And in 54, I had that tremendous year. I still didn't beat the league. I was in the league year. Before that, led the league was a guy from Hornell, Dodger Farm. But that was the year I hit 45 on that.
144 right?
Yeah. And Louisville sent me, I will show you, the Golden Suit, Golden Black Baptist sent me. And I wrote to Reader's Digest, Sports Digest. And people asked me questions or whatever, and I asked him to look it up if I still hold the home run record. They never did answer me.
But now that's for the Pony League, right?
Yeah.
I'll have to Saber check. We can probably get that information.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, that league is not in existence anymore.
Yes, it is.
Oh, it is in
existence? Oh, sure.
Fine.
They have different teams in it now.
Oh.
But the Pony League, yeah, they got Erie and yeah.
Is that a class?
A D. But it's not D now. It's a class A, I think. Because they don't have D's now. Instruction league and whatever.
We've got a minor league committee. I'll check with them.
Good. And it goes along. The following year, the general manager,
1955.
The general manager of Milwaukee, he said, "Ted, we want to go back to Wellsville again because you did a terrific job." And some of the ball players that were sent to me were college ball players that got bonuses of $75,000 to $80,000. So they wanted somebody to school them right.
What were you making as manager?
I don't remember that, but I was not the favorite. That those days. In fact, I bought a new car $800. And when I was with Wellsville, and we were in Erie, a sponsor of the Senators, Mike Canavino, he was general manager of Erie, he said, "Kenny, I'd love to get you here. This is a post town, we're post. We drive them in." And I couldn't do it myself because I still belong to the Braves. And Mr. Quinn called me and said, "Ted, we want you to go back to Wellsville." In the meantime, reading the scoring names, I saw where Quebec or Ottawa, Class Double A or whatever, needs a manager. And I was the next step up to go. And they hired a guy from Kansas City that wasn't in the system. And I was ticked off about that. So anyway, Luigi called Washington.
Nasi Luigi.
And he said, "Try to get Ted Sikorski to get." He said, "We need a guy like that to manage our club." So I think Luigi called me a little bit. And he said, If you ever get the release from Milwaukee, contact me. So I called Mr. Maine, Mr. Finn, and I told him that I don't think I'm going to go back to law school. 2 years of the law. And I showed him I could manage. He said, well, if you want the release, we'll give it to you. So that I got my release assigned with Washington. And in spring training with Washington, I knew I could get a bad shot. The quality of pitching managers wasn't like Milwaukee. Milwaukee gave us private cars. We had private apartments that we stayed in, the managers. We had private dining room that we served. Over at Washington, of course, Griffith was owner, and everything was on the cheap side. In fact, I felt sorry for one kid. They had a lot of high school kids try to go to professional baseball. Milwaukee, when they released the boy, they'd pat him on the back, get his train, a fair airfare ticket to send him home and say, well, be sure and keep in touch with us. Washington, I'm walking down the street with Sherry Robinson, and a kid came in with tears. Sherry and I walked down the street in school with tears in his eyes. I said, Mr. Robinson, I saw my name on the bulletin board. I'm being released. I had to ride back home. And Sherry said, walk, or catch a bus. And to my mind, I said, that's not a right way. And perhaps he got my spare, Greyhound, if I want. Milwaukee, he went home first class. But anyway, I went to Erie, and they had a terrible ballpark, and I just lasted a year, and I said, I'm good now. And I put an ad in Sporting News, Barry McFadden, my credentials, and I got a couple of bites, but sent it over. I said, this is it. Now, in my case, all players who might have a year to go in the big leagues and have retired and get friends.
Today is January 30th. I am Riley Walker. Today I will be playing number 90 and 91 from Action on Achievement on the clarinet. This is my first recording of the semester, and I am focusing on staccato and.
And they would call you up for a year or like 6 months to fill your pension. And then they would release it, but then you weren't big leagues that year. But all of my guys died or retired. I didn't have anybody to report. The only personal guy I had, and of course he told me that he was one of the candidates to manage the Royals. He and Paul Richardson and else. And if he's picked, I'm going to be his third base coach. Billy Southwood. Oh, he treated me like a dad. When he passed away, I just cried because he just took care of me. And he was down Lake Ross, he was a scout of Milwaukee, and he and I were buddy buddies.
Now, 55 was your last year in baseball.
Yeah.
How did you handle the transition from baseball to civilian life?
Well, we were entertained at Marina's restaurant with DiMaggio. Our next stop was D'Alessandro, Mayor D'Alessandro's house, he was right around the corner. And during the course of that conversation, I asked the mayor, I said, Mayor, I don't have a job during the winter to keep in shape. Do you know of anybody? What do you like to drive? I said, I like to drive truck. He said, go see Dollinger, American Oil. We'll put you to work. So the next day or so, I went to see Mr. Dollinger. He said, D'Alessandro already called you. When are you available to work? So I was with the American Oil for 18 years, and I did a small pension for that.
When you played and managed, did you have any trouble with umpires? Any unusual experience?
The first year, I don't know how many times I was thrown out of the ballpark, and to being short-fused. And then I was talking to somebody, who it was, maybe Barry Southwood. He said, Ted, you diplomacy on that car. And he told me what to do, how to go about it. So the following year, I got all kinds of bets. There would be a pitch, 2-2 or something, on one of my guys, and a ball would maybe hit the inside corner of the strut, and that's what I'm calling the ball. And normally, if it's a tight game, you'd get irritated and go out to home plate and start arguing. So I would argue, you're an umpire. I said, Dave, look, I think you're going to be a major league umpire. And I think you missed the stick. I'm not sure, but it looked like it hit the inside corner. And of course, you already called it a ball. And oh, you already called it a strike, strike my man out, and it was inside, so you did. But my first sentence would be, I think it's going to be a major league umpire. And that put a little feather in the sky. So maybe in the course of that ball game, my guy would slide to second base, and there'd be a bang bang play, and I'd probably be out and up over to safe. Give me a little break like that. So I found out psychology means a lot.
You keep in touch with ex-players?
I wrote to, in fact, it really hurts me because I wrote to Hugh Burdett. I room with him in Kansas City. Lou and I, his wife and I, we have a great big mansion. Bishop of that church went to Florida and he rented us this mansion. There was about 15 rooms there. And Mary and Lou and I would go out and eat dinner, whatever. And I wrote him a Christmas card and my wife wrote to Mary, never did get an answer. Sam McDowell, of course, he helped me out. Well, I'm going to get to now as my teeth. But chewing tobacco when I played, 5 years ago, I had a cold sore on my tongue. And through an examination, they found out through a biopsy it was something cancer. So John Hopkins removed it, and the radiation killed all my teeth. And my gums, the bottom gums were weeping. I took 6 weeks of radiation. I dropped from 195 to 145 pounds. I couldn't eat. I only ate chicken noodle soup and scrambled eggs. And I didn't have any saliva or taste buds. After the radiation, it came back to me by a lump of teeth. And I had all my dentures removed, my teeth removed, and I had to get dentures. And $10,000. I don't have any insurance to cover that. Medicare wouldn't cover it. And Stuart, the guy I just talked to, was mad in hell. We're right above on the coast. And he wrote such a nice letter. She in turn forwarded my letter to the Medicare director, Dr. Riker. And he was in touch with me periodically. And the final phone call I got is to Ted, they refused it. Your appeal case. And I told them, Dr. Riker said at the board meeting when he wrote, that this gentleman didn't have dentures put in for cosmetic purposes. He had them in because of a cancer of his tongue, and he had required surgery. And the bottom dentists have to have implants because the gums were destroyed. And that is why Medicare should pay. And he said they refused. I called Stuart. And he called the Kosky secretary, they're appealing it. It's going to Congress, and I don't know what's going to happen. $10,000.
Stuart's your lawyer?
No, he's not my lawyer. He's a friend that wrote me and asked me for my autograph for his son. And then I had the phone number on, and I called him. And I said, Stuart, you know you wrote me for my autograph, his son's in the mail. And he said, Ted, how do you feel? I said, well, not too good. I have dentures put in this and that. And I told him the whole story. He said, wait a minute. We'd like to borrow that. Maybe she can help us.
I hope Senator Mikulski would come through.
Yeah.
Baseball is different today. How would you say
The biggest thing in baseball now is hitting. Wow. A man asked me that one time, and I said, look, I'm going to compare it to something. If you were in a factory sharpening tools, chisels, and I told you I was your boss to sharpen this chisel, and I gave you pairs of the safety glasses, you would get down to the grinding wheel and sharpen, razor sharp. if I took the safety glasses out from you, how would you shorten it? I said, keep my hair away, and I don't know how I'd shorten it, but I'd shorten it. I'm comparing hitters, then to now. We never had skull caps. I remember playing in Newark when I was with the Orioles, and Sammy Bell was an expert. No, he played for us, but he was getting of age. And he told me he could steal the signs of Bearer or whoever's catching for Newark. And if he's on second base, he'd relay it to me. Two arms, your curveball went on to your fastball. So Tommy Burns pitched it. He throws 95, 97 miles an hour. So Sammy's on second base, and I'm a left-hand hitter, and I'm looking at him, he's got a curveball. So I'm waiting. Curveball's coming to my head, but I'm waiting for it to break. Tommy Byrne crossed up the catcher through a fastball, took the button off my cap. That's how close I was to getting hit in the head and maybe killed. So the guys now got skull caps. They got things on their left cheek and all, they get hit, you know. So, the umpires are sharper. Conditioning, we never had conditioning. The playing fields are great. The travel is first class. You've got buffet dinners in the clubhouse, which is good. And first of all, they got it made now, the salaries and everything. But anyway, when I played, it was harder to get in the big leagues. You had 8 teams in the American National League, and they picked the cream of the crop. Nowadays, you've got 32 or whatever, I don't know how many. 16 and 14. And if you hit 240 in the minor leagues and hit 25 home runs, you're going to the big leagues for sure. If you're a pitcher and you win 12 to 15 games, you're going up. When I played, you had to hit 310 or 320 and be a pitcher and win 20 games in minor leagues before you got a shot in the big leagues. That's compared to where I compare.
Okay, Ted, you mentioned you have a hobby about making lamps from bats.
Right.
Can you explain that?
In 1954, I made a tooth bat, and a lawyer friend of mine said, you should patent it, because this thing can snowball. So we patented it, went to Washington and so forth. But anyway, since that time, I've made them for Williams, Bear, Feller, DiMaggio, Mantle, and ooze and ooze of them. And the bats were easy to get, and they're very minimal as far as cost. And now the bats run you between $100 and $110, and they're hard to get because you have to get permission from the golf bat. In fact, I had 2 orders for Herman Keller's bat, and I wrote him another good list of my letters. So if I get a hold of Cal Ripken bat or McGuire, I have a couple of McGuire's and a couple of Cal Ripken's, but they are very, very hard to get. And the lamps I made are in big people's homes. And it's my hobby. I like to